This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, delivering specialty foods and ingredients right to your restaurant, bakery, and bar. Learn more at parisgourmet.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat & Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I saw that you do the dough in batches. I do the same thing. I do 3-4 batches. Don't you think that doing that can help you out if something happens? Like, if something is not right, you can understand and you can adjust it, because if one batch didn't went right, you have always something that to recover with. Don't you think that that helps you in your job? Or
A little bit. I mean, we always have multiple batches going, so worst case scenario, you know, we only have half of the amount of dough that we need for the night, so we'll close a little early.
That's my thought, exactly.
But there's, you know, usually one night a year that we have to either close the restaurant or close early because something happened, whether it's complete over-fermentation or refrigerator went down or something that...
Yeah. Well, it happened to me, too.
That is Dan Richer of Raza Pizzeria in Jersey City, New Jersey, and Daniele Uditi, a Pizzana restaurant in Brentwood, California. Our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and thank the Lord, I have with me today Caitlin Friedman. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Andrew.
These introductions, Caitlin, you don't even listen to the show. The degree to which we, and for new listeners, Caitlin often joins me for these intros because way back when the show started, I quickly realized that I have a terrible time doing introductions by myself. I need to be talking with somebody.
And I'm that person. I think it's you just don't love being alone.
I don't like being alone. That's the irony of my life as a writer. I'm trying to become a podcaster forever. But I was last week in a hotel room in San Diego. I was at the Chef's Roll conference and whispering because it was 6:30 in the morning. And it was a terrible intro. Terrible. As always, probably not as terrible as I thought. But when you're here, it's just everything elevates.
Thank you, honey.
It's true.
Okay.
It's totally true. How you been?
So busy. Lots of travel.
Yeah. We don't see each other very much.
No, maybe that's why the intros are good. We can catch up.
This is our time.
This is it. This is all
this
we
is
have.
This is our date. This is our date night. Okay. Well, before we jump in, I'll quickly just say, this is a kind of a different episode. You know, I'd like to say that this is a chef show, not a food show, and that I'm a chef writer, not a food writer. But this show today is largely about food. I have two of the top, I don't know what you call these people anymore. I mean, classically, they would be pizzaiolos or pizza makers. These guys are both, I think, probably known as chefs in their own right now. I don't want to get hung up on names. That's something I've learned doing this show, is I think categories are bad and unhelpful. But two of the top pizza makers in the United States today. Pizza is, as you know, Caitlin, a craze. And to a degree that you and I don't really participate in. You know, is it Neapolitan or not authentic Neapolitan? You know, this kind of thing.
I actually had no idea.
You know, pizza's a big deal, though.
I know pizza's a big deal. I didn't know that people were into that level of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So these two are two of the top guys from different coasts. I had met Dan Richard last year. Ed Levine of Sirius Eats took me to dinner at Raza, which has been acclaimed by many people as the best pizza in New York, even though it's just across the Hudson River in Jersey City. It's phenomenal what he does there. He is absolutely obsessed with details, sourcing, how he makes the dough, everything you can imagine. We actually talk about all that in the show. And then Daniele Uditi, who's actually Italian by birth, has a restaurant called Pizzana in Brentwood, which is acclaimed. And Daniele was in town doing a dinner at Raza. Dan later this year is going to go to Brentwood and do a dinner with Daniele, the collaboration dinner. And I ran over there and we had a talk about pizza, about what makes these guys so obsessed with it, about how they go about it, about what differentiates them, about this moment in pizza love in the United States that we're in right now. And that's what the interview is. It's fun. It's the two of them.
I can't wait. Also, I love the pizza. You came home after
the interview. Oh, yeah. Dan sent me home with pizza for you guys.
And I have to say, it was gone in probably 15 seconds.
Yeah, well, I can confess now. The whole interview was just a ruse for me to not have to wait in line to get pizza for my family.
Well,
I'm just kidding. But they don't take reservations. So Dan was very generous and sent me home with pizza for the fam. Anyway, that's what this interview is. Before we jump into that, though, I just want to let people know I have two very exciting things coming up that I almost don't even consider these plugs, Caitlin, because they're much bigger than me. I'm going to be at the LA Chef Conference on May 20th, and that is the second annual LA Chef Conference. But if you didn't hear about the first one, if you did and were there, you probably loved it. But this one is part of the LA Times Food Bowl, which is a month-long series of events. It is an incredible lineup of chefs discussing various things, doing various things. It's an all-day affair. It's in Santa Monica. Just some of the chefs who are going to be there: Suzanne Goen, Curtis Stone, our friend Tim Hollingsworth, and people from the LA Times, like a writer I admire, Amy Scattergood. But that's just a few names out of a couple dozen. And I am going to be there, and I'm so tickled about this. We're going to do a Chef's Drugs and Rock and Roll panel discussion as part of the conference. And among the people on the panel, or I should say the entire panel, it's Michael McCarty of Michael Santa Monica, who was our guest last week. Susan Feniger, one half of the legendary team of Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger. Russ Parsons, the former LA Times food editor and writer. John Sedler, who had a restaurant back in the day called St. Estefe that was very important. And more recently had the restaurant Rivera in Los Angeles that sadly closed, but just a huge, huge talent. And Barbara Lazaroff, the co-creator, designer of Spago, Chinois on Main, and a lot of other very important, influential restaurants, and also the ex-wife, as people probably know, of Wolfgang Puck, but one half of the team that created all those restaurants. And I will be moderating that talk, and then there will be a book signing. How's that sound?
That sounds amazing. And what are the dates?
That is just May 20th.
Okay. This is also how we find out one another's schedules.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I'll be away May 20th, honey.
Okay.
Anyway, to buy tickets, LAChefConference.com is where you go. And the other event I want to tell people about, if there are any people out there who are interested in becoming a writer or a podcaster or a photographer, there is a new conference being put on called the Food Media Lab. It's the creation of a writer. I think this guy is pound for pound probably the best food writer in America right now, John Birdsall. Andrea Nguyen, another great writer. Jody Liano, the founder and owner of the San Francisco Cooking School. And this is taking place at the San Francisco Cooking School for 3 days, June 17th, 18th, and 19th. It's basically 3 days of instruction and mentorship for people trying to figure out how to get into this crazy business, which is increasingly difficult to get into from the journalist side. And I will be teaching a, or co-teaching a, I guess you'd call it a module, on podcasting. I'll be teaching about podcasting. And on June 18th, after the second day of the conference, I will be doing a live show. I will be doing a one-on-one interview with Preeti Mistry, the San Francisco-based chef. And then I will be doing a panel, moderating a panel of people who knew and work with the legendary chef Judy Rogers, who we sadly lost several years ago, of Zuni Cafe. This is the 40th anniversary of Zuni Cafe. And we'll have people, both current and past members of the kitchen team at Zuni, talking about Judy and her legacy. And I'm really excited. That's only our second live show.
That sounds amazing.
So that's it. For information about all of that, go to thefoodmedialab.com. Again, thefoodmedialab.com. The is part of the website name. You can also go to my blog, tokeland.com, and navigate to the appearances page to click through to both of those events, or my Instagram feed, which is at Chef Podcast. Go to the link in the bio, and you will see links to all of those things on my super hyperlink on Instagram. So that's that. Okay, without any further ado, I'm now going to start my interview with Dan Richer of Raza and Daniele Uditti of Pizzana, recorded at Raza in the office above the restaurant a couple of weeks ago in Jersey City, New Jersey. Here you go.
We're doing a pop-up.
Yeah.
At our restaurant, Raza, in Jersey City.
Mm-hmm.
Daniele graciously flew out here this week to make pizza for one night.
Okay.
And then I'm going out there in 2 weeks to make pizza with him for one night.
And do you guys, how much do you guys know each other before this?
We met two or three times. Once we met through Instagram, and then came to Pizzana, and he texted me. It's like, "Hey Daniele, I'm coming. You guys have a spot available?" So of course I have a spot available. What are you talking about? So come over. So he came over, and I forced him to eat the entire menu at Pizzana.
There's this pizza thing happening in this country right now. You say you met on Instagram. You two were aware of each other. You know, I think of it almost like in the old West. You know, the way gunslingers knew about each other, except that it's friendly. Like you've heard of each other.
Totally.
You know, you know about each other. You've heard things about each other's pizza. You know, but you don't really know how true it is until you taste it. Right? How big a group of pizza makers, pizzaioli? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did I say that okay?
Yeah.
Pizzaioli.
I hate that word.
You hate? Well, we'll talk about
that
in a minute.
So much.
But how big is the, how many people are in this constellation of pizza makers in this country where you all sort of know about each other or interested? How big a group is that?
It's getting bigger all the time through social media, plus especially through the pizza trade shows.
Mm-hmm.
We met last year at the Pizza Trade Show, right, in Vegas?
Yes. We met last year at Pizza Trade Show, thanks to Noel.
Yep.
And, yeah.
There's a lot of us out there.
Yeah.
And what's a lot? Like, hundreds?
Sure.
Really?
Yeah.
But at the upper... Because to the average, like, to the foodies, to the food writers out there, I mean, I guess I'll say this. Hopefully you guys will let me leave the room alive. I can't get that crazy about anything.
Well,
right?
We do this on a daily basis.
No, this is your lives, right?
Totally.
But I'm saying, so I don't know. But there are people who are pizza fanatics, right? The way there are pizza who are burger fanatics right now, right? And taco fanatics, right? But I would imagine that the upper echelon of people who you guys consider your peers, maybe you're not boastful enough to put it that way, I would think it would be like 20 people, 25 people in this country.
No, actually, luckily, is growing, you know, and I know why he doesn't like that word pizzaioli, because it's just relating somebody that does just pizza. We don't do just pizza. We are artisans. That's the word that you like, right?
Yeah, I think I don't like it because it's there's no equivalent term in English, and I don't view myself as an Italian pizza maker. I'm not from Italy. I'm not Italian. There's nothing about our nothing really about our product that is Italian at this point.
Yeah, but let me tell you, you do a really good job because the pizza is great. So, not Italian, but one of the best pizza I've had. So,
well, what you're from Naples, correct? So, what is the mindset, right? Like what you just said is interesting. It's not Italian, but you do great pizza. What is the mindset? Because it's Italy in general is when it comes to food can be very conservative. Right, very traditional. I remember I had Massimo Bottura on the show, and he was saying, you know, what he does now, which is respected all around the world. When he started doing it locally, he had pushback. Yeah. People weren't interested; they thought it was like sacrilege. Right? What's the attitude? Do you think what you guys do would fly in Italy today? Has it changed that sort of point of view?
Well, it's starting to change, I think, a little bit in Italy too, but. You know, there is when we talk about pizza in Italy, the first thought goes to Neapolitan pizza, and just like I will say like caging that word pizza to a style, to me it's not a good thing to do because that starts to be we have a beautiful friendship, right? Even though if we know each other from a short period of time, but we can talk openly about pizza and respect each other's style. But then as his personal style, I have my personal style. There is not something that cage the word pizza. Like Dan doesn't do Jersey pizza or New York style pizza. He does Dan Richard pizza, and I do Daniele Uditi pizza. And that is the thing that I think that we have to transmit when we do our own things, like not caging the word pizza to a style. And that can open up a lot of doors.
Totally. I think people around the world get stuck on this style mentality where you're doing this style, Detroit style or New York style, and everybody gets fixated on these things of having to use a certain flour, having to use a certain tomatoes, when I just want to make really good pizza.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because both of you, look, no disrespect to the tradition of pizza, right? But in most cases, when you talk about a pizzeria in this country, when you talk about that word I'm not going to say again, but a pizza maker, right? This is probably someone at those places that's kind of their main thing. And they make pizza, and they make traditional pizza. They probably do make it in a certain style, generally speaking. You guys both have... you found your way to pizza. Right? Pizza wasn't... You both worked in kitchens where other things were going on and then sort of settled on pizza as your, I guess I would say your canvas, if that's not too precious, or as your medium or as your specialty. How would you guys put it? What is your relationship? Let me ask it a different way. Daniele, let's start with you. What was the if you remember the moment, or if it was more gradual, what was the progression that led you to say, this is what I'm going to focus on. This is going to be the thing that I really spend my career, developing and honing and making my own. What was the when you decided to go all in on this direction?
Well, pretty much when I set foot in this country. So I came in LA first, and I was making Neapolitan pizza. People like it. Some people don't like it because they consider it too juicy, too soupy. So, while eating it, you know, it's I finding myself, yeah, I like it. It's something that I grew up with. It, maybe that's why I like it. But instead of doing something that everybody was doing, because there's this boom of pizza in Italy too about Neapolitan style, was growing too much. It's like, but I'm going to tell the history of the same history that everybody's telling. So what can I say to people that talks about me? Talks is more personal. So, and I remember when my auntie used to make a bread. It's a bread that was started in 1500 in my little town close to Caserta, and And I remember enjoying so much working with her and taking the leftover of that bread and flatten it out, put toppings, and make it into a pizza. I remember my auntie screaming at me. It's like, what are you doing? This is not pizza. This is sacrilegious. It's not pizza. It's bread. I said, yeah, but it tastes good like a pizza too. So why not? And that moment in my mind, since I was 12, I always told myself, it's like, bread and pizza are not that far apart. It's same things. It's flour, water, a fermentation agent, a fermented agent, and salt. So
you were a nonconformist even as a child.
No, I like that moment of sharing. To me, pizza is a sharing moment. You go out with your family, you have a slice of pizza, and there is nothing more sad to me than grabbing a slice of pizza and all your ingredient falls off on the slice, they end up on a plate, and then you are left with this like floppy, wet piece of dough. As at the end of the day, it's better if I do bruschetta. It's the same thing. I give a bite and all the tomatoes fall off.
Yeah, it's like when the ice cream falls off the cone.
It doesn't make any sense to me. So that's why I went back to my root, my personal heritage, and I just wanted to tell my story. And likely people like my story, so win-win.
Okay. Dan, how about you? When did you decide to leave aside, you have other things on the menu here, but this, you are known for your pizza.
Totally.
Yeah. When was the moment you decided to go all in on that?
So I knew very early on that I wanted to open a restaurant. My first trip to Italy was when I was 21 or 22. I came home from that trip and knew I wanted to bring really delicious food to New Jersey. So I bought a failing restaurant in 2006. Had two wood-fired ovens, had a pizza recipe. It was terrible, but I wanted to maximize these two wood-fired ovens that were in the restaurant, so I started really studying bread-making techniques and cheese-making techniques and started to really focus a lot of attention on pizza.
Was it a function of the ovens? Was it just fate?
It was just, I had these two wood-fired ovens, so if you're not making really good pizza,
yeah,
what are you doing? It's a waste of time.
What were the examples that led you to start examining, because this is what you're known for, right?
Yeah.
You are known for obsessively examining and decision making on each detail
totally
of the pizza. You don't use the same crust for all your pizzas?
We don't have.
Right? Am I wrong? When I came to dinner, didn't I have like three different crusts?
Yeah, our situation's unique here at this restaurant.
Yeah.
We have a very small dough mixer.
Okay.
So we have to mix multiple batches of dough every day.
Yeah.
So we get the opportunity to play around and do side-by-side
right
pizzas. We'll do one day where we're working on two different flours. Mm-hmm. So we'll use King Arthur all-purpose flour on one batch and Central Milling their all-purpose flour on the second batch.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the night, we'll test them side by side with all other things being exactly equal.
Interesting.
Some days we'll do the same flour, but do two different dough temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
See what the results are. We'll do one that's completely naturally fermented with no commercial yeast, and then the other batch will have a tiny bit of commercial yeast. And we're able to really see the textural differences and flavor profile differences between the two, because you're doing them side by side.
Right. And you're, Daniela, you're nodding as he says all this. You've gone through a similar, or you just relate to this kind of a trial and error?
Oh, I just got lucky. I was born in a family with a recipe, and I didn't have to do that much work to do. So I flew with my starter from my family. It was started 64 years ago for my auntie. Luckily, custom didn't stop me and make me throw away. So I entered this country with an illegal fermented starter. And I started to make pizza with that, fed them, and then that's what it is, you know. And I still make the dough by hand. And he like to pick
pick on me. It's like, why don't you get a dough maker? Because mixer. Because I never used one. I'm probably gonna be dumb using it. So I just like the feeling to feel the flour with my hands. And probably one day I will end up doing, and I will ask him for a suggestion. But for now, you know, I'm still gonna stick with my beautiful hands to make the dough. So
I didn't grow up in a family of pizza makers or bread makers or anything like that. So the journey for me of learning how to do this has been very challenging and very rewarding at the same time. Having to learn from the very beginning how to deal with season changes, how to deal with humidity changes, how to deal with flour lot changes. Every day is such a challenge trying to maintain consistency, but also push the product to its limits in terms of flavor and texture.
Yeah, but that's not going to stop. Even for me, it's the same thing. It's even with a lot of experience, and even I have the luck to be born in a family of bread makers, you never know what's going to happen, you know, because especially in L.A., there is a temperature change between the morning and night is like a lot of degrees, and then it can shock the dough, you know, it can shock your bacteria. And when I came here, sometimes I ended up with a dough that doesn't want to grow up, that doesn't want to proof, doesn't want to ferment. I said, well, oh my God, what am I going to do? Did I do something wrong? And I had like books on books and reading recipes, what I did wrong, calling my auntie in Italy, said, what I'm doing wrong? I said, nothing. Did you check the temperature? Oh, that probably might be. So yeah. I started to work with thermometers and, some stuff that in Italy, pizza makers don't even use. And in Italy, there is this myth of the point of the dough, right? They keep adding flours until they touch the dough and they say it's done. To me, there was always something that I couldn't understand. So that's why I asked for my auntie recipes. And then I started to study hydration. I came here just with the recipe, but then you have to study all this stuff. You need to be able to explain people that are eating your pizza what is the process in your dough that make it special, that make it healthy, that make it digestible. Because a proof dough doesn't mean that it's a good dough. You can put a lot of yeast in your pizza, make it proof. Yeah, the bacteria are going to eat the sugars and poop out carbon dioxide, and then it gets stuck in the gluten shirt, and then it proofs. But that doesn't mean that it's digestible. So it needs to do other process to reach that. And then I had to study that, probably the same thing that you had to study that.
Yeah, so, not specifically to make it necessarily more digestible, but to make it taste better. The proof is in the flavor. You can tell when something has been properly fermented.
I agree.
If it's just been inflated with carbon dioxide, there's absolutely no flavor. And yeah. I think that 99% of the pizza out there in the United States is that. It's kind of flavorless.
It's like an air balloon, right? It's just like putting air in something and then giving a bite out of air. You taste air. That's all you taste. But there's not the lining of texture. There is not, you don't taste the grains. You know, there is millers that work I don't want to use a bad word, but they beep off. And, I think as an artisan, or like as a pizza maker, you need to respect that. You know, you need to show the work that somebody else done with the product that you're using. So,
yeah, and you have to understand what they go through in order to flex with the season changes and temperature changes and all that. You have to understand the flour in order to get a really high quality and consistent product.
You see why we go really well together? We have the same idea of pizza in maybe different styles, but it's our own personal style. But the idea, the heart is in the right place, you know, that goes in the same direction. We just want to give to people a really good product that tastes good and is good for you. So,
yeah.
Okay, so tell me what are the differences between you guys? To follow up on what you just said, Daniele, where do you guys diverge in your pizza styles?
Well, so he's a Neapolitan, right? He's from Italy. So you use some
Italian ingredients, and you mm-hmm. grew up eating that pizza. Yeah. Like, I fundamentally don't love Neapolitan pizza. That's not my favorite style. I didn't grow up there. I enjoy it when it's made really, really well.
What doesn't work for you about it?
It's mostly having to do with the texture, but also the fact that most Neapolitan pizza is not, it's not cut, right? It's not sliced. It's not a shareable food. There's a fundamental difference between pizza in Italy and, or Neapolitan pizza and American pizza. American pizza is always sliced, okay? It's the world's most shareable food.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And because it's sliced, it needs to be sturdier. It needs to be crispier, okay? So the pizza I grew up eating in New Jersey and New York is always crispy. Bite into it and you hear an audible crunch.
Yeah, or if you fold it in half to walk, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's foreign in the Naples area. That's not a Neapolitan thing. It's an individual thing. Everybody gets their own pizza. It's a fork and knife thing. Mm-hmm. It's not this, let's get one big pie for the table and we'll all take a slice. Okay, that's one of my favorite things about pizza and pizza in the United States of America. That's our mark on pizza, is making pizza shareable and making it equitable and mm-hmm. fair for all. I just love that about American pizza and our mark on pizza.
Mm-hmm. So you like a crispier pizza?
Totally.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Well, because I grew up with my auntie making bread, and with leftover bread, we would make pizza. The oven temperature was lower to bake bread, so that ended up of making the pizza be really soft on the inside, but there's this little layer on the outside, that's crunch, that it gives you the pillowy experience, but not losing the texture. So I love that kind of experience that I had as a child. And I still love it now, you know. And, you know, the thing about Neapolitan pizza, if you think about it, usually Neapolitan pizza is cooked for 60 seconds, 90 seconds, 60 to 90 seconds, right? In an oven, there is 800, 900 Fahrenheit, right? If we add another 600, 700 Celsius, we reach the point of melt of glass. Is that amazing? So, like, if you keep putting wood, you can melt glass in it. So my question is this, logical. How you can cook a piece of dough that weight 300 grams, from 250 to 300 grams in 60 seconds, with ingredient on top that needs to be married, and also give the people the experience of the wood-burning flavor? I don't think it's possible. That's my own... It's not because, you know... I hear we want to talk about, garbage about Neapolitan pizza. You know, it's something that I grew up eating it. You know, it's not my favorite thing. We are talking about personal experience. But to me, it's impossible to cook a piece of dough, a piece of bread, or a piece of dough in 60 seconds and give the customer the experience of wood-burning oven and cooking and marrying the ingredient in 60 seconds. I heard people searing fish in 60 seconds with a flame, but never cooking.
That's funny. So. I think that I don't want to take anything away from Neapolitan pizza. I mean, they're obviously doing something right.
Well, I was just going to say, everything you guys are saying, you just said it, Daniel. It's just your personal...
Totally.
It's just your personal taste.
And, you know, I look at people like Una Pizza Napolitana, Anthony Mangieri, and that's Neapolitan-style pizza. And it's incredible. When it's done really, really well with a lot of care and attention to detail, it's a beautiful thing. But it's not my favorite style of pizza, and I have never had the desire to make that style of pizza.
So when you were developing your style, right, let's imagine that you were sort of an arrow, right, traveling through space, okay? Did you know what the bullseye was, or was it strictly screwing around in the kitchen, trying different doughs, trying different cook times, and, you know, like at the eye doctor, better or worse? Better or worse? Yes. Until you got to a place that you were happy.
Well, it definitely wasn't a straight line by any means.
So you didn't know where you were going.
Okay. So what I knew is I didn't want to do Neapolitan-style pizza.
Okay.
At the time, I was eating as much pizza as I possibly could. I was in the city doing pizza tours, you know, six pizzerias in a day, twice a week, you know, nonstop eating pizza.
Now, can I ask you a potentially a jerky question?
Bring it.
were you being a snob about it, or were you going to like, were you going to places just along Sixth Avenue that are just your average New York utility slice pizza? Or were you just going to like Lombardi's and, you
going
know,
to every place that I possibly could.
You were just going on a pizza crawl.
Mostly to places that had wood fired ovens because okay. I owned a pizzeria with mm-hmm. wood fired ovens. So I really wanted to learn about, I wanted to experience as much wood fired pizza as I could.
Yeah.
Every single time that I went, I left feeling like, I just don't really like this. So I started being very introspective. Like, what don't I like about this? And typically it came down to the textural components. I love the flavors. I just didn't like the texture. I didn't like that fast bake that left the pizza a little softer and wetter. And I wanted to create something that was more like what would come out of an electric oven or a gas oven or a coal oven. When I was creating our product, I started doing dough trials. Okay, I was trying a different dough every single day. Okay, and we're not talking using somebody else's recipe. Okay, because pizza dough is flour, water, salt, and yeast of some sort. Okay, so I would try this hydration one day, a lower hydration the next day, a higher hydration the next day, until I achieved the hydration level that made me happy. So I was doing all these trials, and I needed to come up with a way to log them so that I can learn from all of these trials, because dough making is there's a huge lag time. Okay, what you tried today, you're not going to experience it until tomorrow or the next day. So you tend to forget what subtle changes you make. So I came up with a log system of what did I change, what are the results, and what am I going to do the next time? And then I started to come up with a list of what am I trying to achieve here? So I came up with a list of all the parameters that I wanted in my ideal pizza. And it started out with like a list of 10 characteristics that I want in my pizza. I want it to be crispy. I want it to be deeply caramelized on the outside. I want the cheese to be fully melted. Okay, and then this list of 10 characteristics, we've slowly added to it over time. And now it's about 50 characteristics long. It's a 5-page document with dimensions, like it's legitimately a set of pizza blueprints for our pizza, for Razza Pizza. That's what we're shooting for. And now I use this document to train incoming employees and to hold ourselves accountable every night for what our pizza should be. And we're able to keep it consistent because we know what we're shooting for. It's a roadmap for our pizza.
Is there anything else in your life that you pursued with this kind of single-mindedness? Like, are you an obsessive person? Were you obsessive as a child? Are you a collector of things? Like,
I could have some hoarding tendencies.
You do? I didn't even mean that.
No.
You're joking?
I am joking.
Okay.
I am joking.
But are there things that you've obsessed on over in your life? I don't mean it in a derogatory way.
I'm a little bit OCD.
Yeah.
Both of my parents were a little bit obsessive.
Uh-huh.
My mom was a calligrapher.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, so she would sit there night after night and practice her handwriting.
Okay.
And that's what she did for a living. One thing, and just focused and just trying to get better over time. And now when I look back on some of her artwork between like, you know, the early 80s to the late 90s, like 20-year period, you can see this crazy progression from an amateur
Interesting.
To an expert craftsman.
You relate to that.
Totally.
Yeah, how about your dad?
My dad was just a little obsessive about...
Okay.
Things like the New York Yankees and gardening.
Stats and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Okay, and then seed types and all that. And the
all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. But never channeled. And
right.
For me, I can be obsessive, and having this thing that I can channel that obsession is really important for me, because mm-hmm. then if I didn't have this, I'd probably go a little crazy.
Or be driving people in your life crazy.
Totally.
Yes, 100%. Totally. Well, so, hold on.
That proves to do this job, to be a baker, to be, involved with this kind of experience, you need to have that obsession. Otherwise, you won't achieve what you want to achieve. You know, you just will stop on a recipe. Yeah, it is good. And then you will leave it as is and then take care of other people. And then I think the mistake that most of people do, you know, you don't pursue it. You don't, even every day, you need to teach people how to replicate your vision. So you need to be there. You need to inspire people. And you need to translate that obsession that you have in really positive energy to make that piece of dough telling your story every day in the same way with the same standards. So you need to have an OCD. Otherwise, you cannot do this job.
But you can do the job, you know, if you don't have the obsession. Your product is not going to be that good. Yeah. And for me, like, I signed my first commercial lease when I was 26 years old. I don't come from money. I borrowed a ton of money from random people, and failure wasn't an option. So I had to make sure the product was good enough to get our guests, to make our guests happy, and to get my staff paid. And those are really the two driving forces behind wanting to make a great product, is so I don't fail, so I can pay the rent, I can get my staff paid.
I've been through the same process. You know, I borrowed money from my partner. We opened up a place together, you know, and in LA it's not cheap to open up a place. So
where's the original place?
The original place is called Pizzana. And it's in Brentwood. It's a really high-end neighbor, you know, and there's a lot of families. We were shooting for family style, you know. We want family to come to the restaurant and enjoy basically the same experience as a kid. But, you know, that neighbor cost some money. So, you know, my obsession was to not make my partner, like, down. You know, they gave me an opportunity. I came in this country with $300 in my pocket. I didn't come for money either, so we relate on that totally. 100%.
Didn't you live in a van for 6 months?
Yes. No, not that much. It's not 6 months. It's a little less. But me and my brother came 6 months. It's too much. It's not three months. We were showered on Venice Beach, and we tried to make a living.
Special.
What, like over by Muscle Beach over there?
Yeah. Close to that. And actually, we were waiting the nighttime. Luckily, in LA, it was hot at the time, because in the morning there were the police that doesn't let you shower with soaps on the freaking beach. So they were like, hey guys, you cannot do that. Luckily my brother speak English, because I didn't speak one word of English. I would just like shower myself. And you know, we had to do what we had to do. But at the end of the day, we encountered in our path beautiful people. We start to work in a local pizzeria, and some good review came, some celebrity came along. So we got a really good following. And then my partner came along, they tasted the pizza. They were interested in this different approach about the pizza that an Italian was doing. And we ended up doing business together. So
can you tell this story? Because you were doing private parties, no?
Yes.
And that's how your partners discovered you?
Yeah. Well, the first guy that gave me the opportunity, and then we are really good friends, Chris O'Donnell. Mm-hmm. And Chris was so great with me. Invited me to his house. Says, listen, I have a pizza oven. Your pizza is really good, but I can't figure out a way to make it work, you know. And I went to his house. I went 5 hours before. I said, what the hell are you doing here 5 hours before? Well, we need to light up the oven. I need some charcoal. The oven needs to be purified, because you probably don't use it every day. There was a bunch of stuff on the dome and stuff where we cleaned the oven, prepped everything from scratch, from the farmer's market to his house. And he was like, oh, I didn't know the pizza was all this work. I said, well, I don't take less than this. So
he started to make a couple of pies with me, and then after a couple of pizza, he said, you know what? I think you have a future in this job. So you keep doing pizza. I'm going to go in the over there, have a glass of wine, enjoy my guest, and I think you can do this, right? And then that's how we started. And Chris introduced me to other people and other people to other people, and I created a business from scratch. Then my partner came along, Pizzana opened up, and thanks to Jonathan Gold, it got crazy. And, you know, I owe to them and a lot. So I keep remembering in my heart every day. Yeah. And, you know, I can't... He basically wrote a love letter to Pizzana. And, you know, it's so little I can say. Just chapeau. That's all.
Daniele just tipped an invisible hat to the great Jonathan Gold,
yeah,
who I never got to meet, which kills me. But, yeah, we're all still reeling from that loss. You look like you want to say something, Dan.
No.
Oh, no?
I got nothing.
Okay. What, you know, you guys...
I love hearing his story.
This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, a leading specialty food importer and distributor servicing the New York tri-state area and beyond from coast to coast. I'm Jordan Werner Berry, the host of Modernist Breadcrumbs here on HRN. When it comes to freshly baked artisan bread, it's key to pair it with butter that's made with the same amount of care and attention. And you don't have to go all the way to France to find truly amazing butter. Bourmont 83% is an American butter made using traditional French methods. It's produced by a dairy cooperative in New England. And as a Vermont native, I love that this delicious butter is made locally by family farms. Bourmont 83% is great for cooking, baking, and serving on your table with fresh breads and artisan cheeses. It's proudly distributed by Paris Gourmet to restaurants and grocery stores around the tri-state area. Learn more about Paris Gourmet and all of their gourmet savory foods and pastry ingredients at parisgourmet.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Damon Bolte.
And I'm Souther Teague.
Together we host The Speakeasy, a show where we discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe.
Yeah, our guests range from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, hippies and homebrewers, and every expert enthusiast in between.
Browse episodes of The Speakeasy wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to get you back to the rest of my interview with Dan Richer and Daniele Uditi in just a moment. Things move fast here, though. Caitlin has left. One of the things that I did not know, because we don't see each other enough, is that the morning commuter train schedule has changed, and she had to leave earlier than I realized. So she had no more time to join me on the air. Caitlin, thanks for being here. I actually paused the recorder, ran her to the train station, and took it off pause to try to maintain the energy that I gained from Caitlin being here with me. Before we get back to the interview, I want to remind everybody, as you've heard for the last 2 weeks, I recently entered into a promotional partnership with San Pellegrino, my favorite water, and their young chef competition is happening this year and next. There's just under 2 weeks left to apply. You have until the end of April, and I would encourage all young listeners to do that. Now, I described this last week and the week before. It is a global competition, the regional semifinals of which take place this year. And the North American semifinals will be in New York City in November. And if you've ever wanted to be on this show, a small perk of that semifinalist list is that all 10 semifinalists will be interviewed on a special episode of this show, much like the episode I did from the Cayman Islands, or the episode I did at the Philly Chef Conference, or the one I'll be airing next week from the Chef's Roll Conference in San Diego. It'll be sort of a compilation episode featuring all 10 semifinalists. And the North American winner will be the subject of their own episode of this show and will go on to compete in the global finals in Italy in 2020. You don't have to be a chef to enter this contest. You have to have been working in a professional kitchen for at least a year, and you have to have been born after February 1, 1989, which means you're 30 years old or younger. If you're a more mature chef, I would humbly suggest you might recommend this competition to some of your younger colleagues. Now, this is all explained in greater detail on sampellegrino.com, where you can navigate through to the Young Chef competition page, or you can go to the links in my Instagram feed that's at Chef Podcast. And the very topmost link you will see when you click through is a direct link to the application page, and you can find more information about the competition there. Briefly, the cornerstone of the competition is that you must develop a signature dish that shows your personal vision, unique skills, and creativity. I encourage all listeners to do that, and I look forward to sharing and being a part of more programs with Sam Pellegrino in the months and years to come. Okay, with that, everybody, I will now return you to the rest of my interview with two of the best pizzaiolos in the United States today, Dan Richer of Raza in Jersey City and Daniele Uditi of Pizzana in Brentwood, California. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. Loved you guys to just chat for a minute, because, or you can talk to me and riff off each other. But, you know, from the, you guys don't know each other that well. There is clearly a kinship between the two of you. There's clearly a gut level understanding between the two of you. I think the pizza signifies something else. You know, maybe some of these things you guys have in common about your personality, or maybe what you like about what you do. But it was really funny. We were walking up the stairs. You, Daniele, were checking on something about maybe the dough or something for tomorrow night. And Dan said, "So you're happy?" And you said, "Well, I'm okay. Yeah. I am not, you know, it's 24 hours till the dinner. I'm not happy now, but I can go, you know, we can go do the interview."
I was planning to go around the city and check out other pizza places, because, like Dan, one of my favorite styles, if you want to call it that, is New York style. So I like it, the crispy, and I wanted to experience more of those, because I have a chance to be in New York right now. We don't get that lucky usually to travel that much, because we are like in a bunker making pizza. But, you know, yeah, and I don't think I'm going to go anywhere tonight, because I need to check. Until the dough is at the point where I'm happy, I don't think I'm going to sleep tonight. Sorry.
What time you're going to be fine.
What time you close today?
You're good. You're good. You're going to be fine.
Well, you know, it's
always stressful, because it's such a long process. And, you know, you had some setbacks with your starter on the airplane.
Yeah.
That, you know, happened yesterday impacts today, which is going to then impact tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, but luckily we recovered from that. You know, I have, you know, the thing is that I have great people. Like, you have Nick. I have a Fortino. He's a guy that worked with me, and it's 10 years almost that he works for me and with me, not for me. Because we're friends more than colleagues, but he has my same passion for pizza, and he understands the thing that I want. So we were on the phone today. It's like, is everything all right? Is the starter reactor really good today? The liquid is good, you know. And he sent me pictures, you know. And then I came here. I came to check on everything, and touched it. It's okay. Well, we are okay. It's at least there is some activity in the dough. When there is activity, you can always recover from that. The problem is when there is no activity at all.
Totally.
So,
can you explain what that means?
Well, basically,
fermentation.
Yeah, the fermentation.
How do you can just see that?
Well, I can touch it. I think you can see it too. It's a thing that when you've been done this job for a long time, you know, you can see when the dough is alive. You can touch it and you can see it. That is something that I don't know how to explain to people, because it's such a personal thing that you have with your product, that you understand when something is not right, or okay, I think I'm gonna be good tomorrow, or I think I'm gonna be good in 2 hours or in 6 hours. You can understand that. So
yeah, it's a feel, smell, touch thing. It's definitely multi-sensory, and the only way to develop that understanding is by touching it every single day. I have to touch my dough every day. I have to talk about our dough with our team so that they can develop that sense of, okay, where is it? Where's the dough now? Where is it going to be in 6 hours? Where is it going to be tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel? How does it
how does it compare to yesterday? How does it compare to the days before? You know, what direction are we heading? Mm-hmm. Is the season change taking place right now? So our dough is going to start to ferment faster over the next couple of weeks. So we need to slow things down a little bit. Or in the winter, you know, we have to speed things up. And if we're not on top of it on a daily basis, then you know,
you're not going to have dough. Basically, you're not going to have
dough. Yeah, it's going to be a slow deterioration of the quality of your product until it stops fermenting or over-ferments.
Well, I have a question for you. I saw that you do the dough in batches. I do the same thing. I do 3-4 batches. Don't you think that doing that can help you out if something happens? Like if something is not right, you can understand and then you can adjust it, because if one batch didn't went right, you have always something that to recover with. Don't you think that that helps you in your job? Or
A little bit. I mean, we always have multiple batches going, so worst case scenario, you know, we only have half of the amount of dough that we need for the night, so we'll close a little early.
That's my thought, exactly.
But there's, you know, usually one night a year that we have to either close the restaurant or close early because something happened, whether it's complete over-fermentation or refrigerator went down or something that...
Yeah. Well, it happened to me, too. We got hit by, there was like a heavy rain in LA, which doesn't happen that much, but when it happens, the city goes crazy. You know, it's the power is coming to come down, and then we had the refrigerator, and then I had to go at the restaurant and take some of the batches and then take it out, put it in an ice bath, and try to retard something, and then to be open the next day. And we barely made it. We almost sold out, so... It was tough time, yeah.
Yeah, we have multiple formulas. We have an emergency formula for a same day dough. Mm-hmm. So if we get here, you know, when we arrive in the morning and everything's over fermented, we can actually use that as a starter for a same day dough. Mm-hmm. There's always ways to correct issues from having an impact on your business, but you have to recognize them as early as possible because it is such a long process.
Welcome to the land of fermentation.
But honestly, fermentation and the fact that it is so variable is one of the things that keeps me so engaged. I have to consistently learn.
You have to be that engaged.
Have to be. So I need that.
When you or you get bored.
I get bored and I won't get out of bed in the morning.
When you talked about that one night, that you know, the one night a year where you have to maybe not open, right? Is it because the dough is unusable or is it because it's not to your minimum standard? Like if you use that dough when a customer think it was horrible?
Potentially. Okay. You know, you know, if somebody this year it happened, our mixer forgot to add the salt to the dough.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usable, but is it delicious? No. So we closed.
Mm. See, that would seem to me to be a night where maybe a lot of places would not have.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Most places would not be worth taking the financial hit
of losing
a night of business. You'd rather do that.
Yeah, I can't sleep at night if I know that our product is not what it should be.
But think about it, you know, most places don't want to take the financial hit to lose in one night, but I believe it's better to take the financial hit than to give the customers a product that they won't like, or like it's not up to your standard, then maybe you will lose the business in the long run. So it's better to lose one night than lose 6 months. So,
yeah, fair point. So, okay, Daniela used the word artisan before. You don't like the word pizzaiola. What do you call? I'm just curious because I really believe. And I've talked about it with other guests on the show over the last year or so. I think because we're seeing more and more people specialize in different things, because there are new types of venues like food trucks, right? And I think we're going to, you know, it's already happening, right? There are chefs who are, whether they realize it or not, are on their way to becoming permanent pop-up chefs, right? The landscape is changing. The different ways to do what you guys do, let's just broadly call it cooking for other people for money, right? So I don't think it matters, but I am curious. Do you call yourself a chef? What do you call yourself, if anything, and do you think it even matters?
I don't think it matters. I think sometimes people want to know, like, what's your title? So I'll say chef reluctantly. I don't ever use the word pizzaiolo because I'm not Italian. Mm-hmm. I make pizza. I specialize in pizza. I'm not ashamed that this is my specialty. I love
I hope the question didn't imply that.
No, none at all. Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. But a lot of chefs look down on it. A lot of chefs think that they can just, I'm gonna transition into a casual pizza spot and I'm gonna do pizza. And
whoa! I gotta say something. You think a lot of chefs look down on what you do?
Totally.
Oh, I could not. You're nodding, Daniele?
Totally.
Oh my God, I disagree.
Pizza has this lowbrow thing, which I like about it, but I personally think it's the most challenging endeavor any culinary endeavor.
But don't you think most chefs, sorry, I don't mean to argue, but don't you think most chefs, when you ask them where they want to go on a given night, what they want to eat on a given night?
That's a different thing.
No.
Everybody likes pizza.
I don't just mean what Jon Stewart calls utility pizza. I mean pizza at the level that you guys are doing it, where it's treated with the same thought and care that a quote-unquote, you know, traditional restaurant chef treats their signature dishes, right?
I think that they...
I don't think they love it.
Everybody enjoys it.
You think they looked at... I disagree.
I think a lot of chefs think it's something that is very easy and a lowbrow thing.
Really?
Percentage of chefs that think that what we do, it's easy.
Really?
But look at the marketplace. I think the entire world thinks it's an easy thing. Look at our price point. Okay? It takes years and years of studying and practice and trial and error and just doing it constantly, yet we're maxed out at what we can charge, which is, you know, $18, $19,
$20
for a dish.
Well, when you have a meats on top of the pizza, you need to charge a little bit more, so you go over what, $20 sometimes, but that's the price point, so it's absurd for people to pay like $30 for a pizza unless there is truffle, so right?
In New York City, my buddy Anthony Mangieri from Una Pizza just got a really bad review specifically for charging $25 for pizza when the guy's been doing it since 1996. He's a master craftsman, right? And basically nobody wants to pay for quality craftsmanship when it comes to pizza. Mm. I view what we do more similar to a skilled trade, like being a carpenter, right? Okay. Or a cabinet maker.
You think it's a craft?
Totally. Okay. Cabinet makers, right? When you renovate your kitchen, you can buy IKEA cabinets for like $1,000 for your whole kitchen.
Right.
Or you can have custom craftsmanship and skilled labor making these gorgeous, beautiful cabinets, and you're going to pay $50,000 for it. Okay. With pizza, people want IKEA prices and
high quality product.
Not willing to pay for the quality craftsmanship that we're out for.
Sorry if I interrupt you, but I always do the example of the Japanese culture, right? The shokunin, how you call it, they specialize to do one thing, their own life, right? I'm talking about sushi. They spend so much time learning how to wash the rice, how to treat the fish. Like, it's one discipline, right? It's one thing. But on that kind, it's accepted to charge $300, $400, because it's fish, right? Because there is this understanding that fish is expensive, so I'm willing to pay for it. Guys, good flour is expensive.
good cheese is expensive.
Well, yeah. I'm not worried about the cost of ingredients.
Yeah,
okay, because I think a lot of people
you worry about
that.
The craftsmanship, like the time that we spend.
Yes,
I get it, but there is also that part, you know, the business that people I think need to understand too. It's not just it's 100% craftsmanship. You're talking about a guy that's been doing this for 22 years. I was a kid when I started to do this job.
Yeah.
So
I think that people think that because the cost of ingredients is less for pizza than, say, a lobster, right, that our prices should always be lower, right? But when you, like, going back to the cabinetry, right, the cost of the wood is not representative. The cost of the product is not directly related to the cost of the ingredient or raw material, okay? If the wood is not the expensive thing in custom cabinetry. It's the experience of putting it together properly and knowing the species and knowing the moisture content of the wood and knowing how to join the wood together. It's the time and energy spent learning that craft and doing it.
But I think, I mean, this is an interesting philosophical discussion because I think your point, Daniele, to me, I relate to Daniele's point more about ingredients. I don't think the cumulative hours you put in or anyone puts into learning your craft, I don't know how you translate that to the expense of what you guys do, because it's like the movie business, right? You can only charge so much for a movie. It's basically the same ticket to see a low budget movie made for $10 million as it is to see the new Star Wars movie, because you consume it. You know, it's not like a cabinet. You don't take it home and have it for. And one of the reasons the cabinet will last for
that's a very good point.
100 years is the craftsmanship, right? Or when you buy a nice shirt, one of the reasons a well-made shirt will last longer is it's, you know, the higher thread count and da 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 da, da right?
It's a very
you
good
can't.
Point.
I don't see how you translate that training into cost. I do to some extent. Like, it costs more to eat your pizza than it costs to get a slice of some generic place from a dump on 6th Avenue, right? But
it's a very good point. But so when you compare a main course at a pizzeria, you know, one of our pizzas,
yeah,
a 12-inch pizza,
yeah,
at $18 versus a plate of food at a restaurant, you know, a lamb dish for $38.
Yes.
Right? It's a main course. It's the same thing. But because it has a protein on it you can charge more than double what we charge. You know, to your point about the movie business, it definitely is a very good point or the longevity of it. And one of the things that I struggle with about my craft is that it's so impermanent.
Yeah.
It's elusive. All of this time and energy we spent learning this craft, and it's gone in such a fast manner.
Yeah.
And
you struggle with that?
I do.
Do you, Daniele?
Well, 50-50. I have to be honest. I still think that pizza is the, you know, it, to me, it's a vessel to tell, you know, what I want to do. But I understand 100% his point of view. You know, we're spending a lot of hours in our kitchens making the dough. I personally take the time to make the dough by hand, like it used to be made long time ago, which is an extra effort to me. That to me, making the dough by hand adds a layer of texture that I personally like, and I never tried making it with the machine. Probably will reach the same texture with the machine. I will learn it. But for now, I will learn. You guys are pushing me hard. Like,
you can get from point A to point B by walking, or you can drive.
Yeah, of course. But I've been, it's not laziness, you know, that I don't want to learn how to use a machine. It's something that I feel comfortable doing it, and that's why I do it. But, you know, there is labor involved. But it's also there is, like I was telling you, you know, craft machine is 50%. Ingredient is the other 50% to me, because there is a cost on. We can tell all beautiful romances about it, but there is a cost of ingredient, right? There is other craftsmanship behind our job. The flour, there's another craftsmanship job. The salami, the sausage, you know,
the tomato growers.
I tested this pepperoni, right? Yesterday I texted you, right?
Yeah.
Like while I was eating the pepperoni, right?
Yeah.
I said, dude, pepperoni is mind blowing. It's so good, right? Yeah. There is craftsmanship behind that, right? So there's a person that wants to do a really good pepperoni, right? And he got lucky to have found somebody that has your same view, right?
Like, totally. And we pay for it. It's like $13 a pound when you can
there
get
you go.
Any there other pepperoni on the market for like $4 a pound.
There you go. And
so there definitely is a cost associated with higher quality ingredients, without a doubt.
Yeah. So there is, to me, is 50% is the craftsmanship, which we totally put in it, but it's 50% ingredient that follows other craftsmanship. So the reason why we charge sometimes $19, $20, $25 sometimes for a pizza is because, not because you want to rip off people. There is no point in doing that. But there is a cost to an ingredient, and to survive, you know, to make a profit out of it, we need to charge the fare to the restaurant and to the people to pay their paycheck. It's not that we want to, I read some reviews sometimes, you know, and it's like, oh my God, I paid $40 for a truffle pizza,
yeah,
and it doesn't smell like strong like truffle. Yeah, because I don't use truffle oil that is made in a lab. And, you know, I use fresh truffle from Norcia, and that has a cost to me. That's why I'm charging people $40, and it's a steal because people charge a lot more than that. So there is a cost, there is a craftsmanship, and I think people should think about it when they go eat an artisanal pizza made from scratch. So
yeah, and let me rebuff my previous argument about not being able to charge enough for it. One of our core values as a restaurant is to keep it accessible to people. And I love the fact that there's nothing on our menu that's over $19 food-wise. We have some wines that are more expensive, but every food item on our menu is below $19. And it's part of how we do business, is mm-hmm. keeping it accessible. Because, like I said earlier, pizza is... American pizza especially is the world's most shareable and equitable and fair food, and it should be part of our business model to keep it fair and accessible to everyone. That's why nothing on our menu is over $19, and that's what also why we don't take reservations. It's fair, equal, and equitable for everybody, and shouldn't not be.
I wish I could do that too.
Yeah.
I need to take reservation, otherwise I will be a piece of people every night.
Oh, we do all the time, and it's unfortunate. It's really difficult to eat at our restaurant, but I love that it's fair and equal for all. It's first come, first serve.
Mm-hmm.
First people who get here are going to get the first pizzas.
Well, luckily, when you come to LA, we're going to sell tickets.
So. Yeah, I know.
We won't have anybody fighting for it.
Okay, last question for you guys.
Bring it.
I want you to tell me, how do I want to put this? You choose how you want to do it. Either, it's probably the same answer, either the pizza of your own pizza variation that you do, that either sums up what you think you're about pizza-wise, or just your favorite one to eat of your own.
I mean, that's such a hard question.
Is that like Sophie's Choice? You can't like, it's like picking between your kids?
Kind of, yeah. If I didn't truly believe in it, it wouldn't be on our menu. I mean, I have off the top of my head three. Let's take two. One is our hazelnut pizza.
Mm-hmm. How's it made? I mean, not from top to bottom, but like the hazelnut part.
So the condiments, the toppings, Rutgers University has been breeding hazelnuts for the past 24 years because in the early 1900s, before the early 1900s, the hazelnut was one of our predominant trees on the East Coast. A fungal disease called filbert blight came in and wiped out the entire population. So Rutgers has been grafting European trees onto American rootstocks and creating this, trying to outbreed the disease and creating this new hazelnut tree that will grow very well on the East Coast. There's a worldwide shortage of hazelnuts, so they're trying to outbreed the disease and breed the perfect hazelnut in terms of size, flavor, fat content, certain genetic characteristics, like whether that little papery skin on the hazelnut, whether that peels off or doesn't peel off, that's a genetic characteristic that they're trying to outbreed. So Rutgers came to me and said, you know, we have 10,000 trees, 10,000 hazelnut trees on the East Coast. Like, we have a ton of hazelnuts. Can you do something with them? I said, absolutely, yes. Not realizing what it would entail to actually get the hazelnuts out of the shells. At the beginning, I couldn't even figure out how to get them out of the shells on a mass scale. We were cracking them one at a time at the beginning, but it takes a lot of pain. So we created a pizza around the hazelnuts. We have a lot of other pizzas throughout the year with a similar story where we're inspired by one ingredient, whether it's corn or pepperoni or hazelnuts. Take this beautiful, pristine, perfect raw ingredient and then create a pizza around it. It's less about me and less about what I want to do to create this beautiful pizza and more about what's given to us and what's available and what's here.
I love that. That's great.
That and the margarita pizza. I can't stress that enough. If I could do one thing for the rest of my life, it would be to make a margarita pizza in multiple variations and just do that one thing. Dough, the sauce, and the cheese, and the basil. And there's so many unique combinations. I mean, just like we talked about earlier where I have multiple dough batches comparing, contrasting, we do that with cheeses also a lot. We do that with tomatoes every single night. We always have multiple tomatoes in the restaurant. And we use them for different purposes, and they're kept at different moisture contents based on what other ingredients are going on the pizza. All of these things are so much, they're so engaging to me, and they really...
You're talking like somebody would talk about like a riff, like a jazz riff.
Totally, yeah. Variations on a theme.
Variations on a theme. Okay, Daniele, however you want to answer the question, or however you don't want to answer it.
I play saxophone, so I understand the way.
I play saxophone too. Oh. Actually, I did in fourth grade.
You guys just find that out,
yes,
for this? I'm telling you, there's something else going on here. There is something.
Jazz music, right? I guess.
There's something deeper between you guys than just pizza. But anyway.
Well, you know, what was the question again?
It was either your favorite of your own pizza to eat.
The pizza you do that you think most sort of sums up your style?
We have the same idea about margarita pizza. On my menu, I have the Neo Margarita, which is a variation of the margarita. It's, you know, to me, on a margarita pizza, there is or too much basil or there is not enough basil. That was my biggest issue, you know, and I love basil so much that we created, you know, a margherita pizza. There, the base is fior di latte from Agerola, and then there is a Parmigiano Reggiano, and there is the sauce, our tomato, that are San Marzano, from San Marzano, which we have a little field where people grow tomatoes for us, for Pizzana. So San Marzano is a small city up on the Mount Vesuvius. You know, I see a lot of those San Marzano DOP. There is no way in the world that they can supply everybody. So there is a region in San Marzano. Depends where you plant it, the flavor changes a little bit, you know, because the minerals, the soil is a little bit different. So we went to meet this guy up on the Mount Vesuvius, and I like so much their tomatoes that we start a collaboration. So we cook down those tomatoes for 6 hours, and then it becomes like almost a paste. It's a concentrated tomato flavor, San Marzano tomato flavor. We dot the pizza with it, and then the basil becomes a crumbs. So like it's almost a powder that we sprinkle on top of the pizza. It's to have you the experience of margarita on steroids. That's how I call it. So it has really rich flavor, still holds the crispiness, and to me it's the perfect margarita pizza.
Great. I love that.
Yeah, and I love that it's a unique take on something so classic.
Right.
And you know, when I was eating his Neo Margarita, I just completely fell in love because, like I said, I'm all about the variations of the margarita. It's really delicious
pepperoni.
And so unique. I would never think to do what you did.
To pepperoni. Now my obsession is to find
a good enough pepperoni, because now I have high standards, because he has one of the best pepperoni in the country, I think. So I'm going to be obsessed about pepperoni. That's my next quest. That's pepperoni awesome. Quest.
Yeah, we never set out to do a pepperoni pizza on our menu. And it wasn't on the menu for the first 3 years or so. And one day I was just like, you know what? We can make a better pepperoni pizza than what's currently available in the market.
Well, you did. I love it. Actually, can we go down and have another? Yeah, yeah, please.
We can do that.
Thank you.
We can do that.
Awesome.
What else?
Perfect
what else?
Ending. No, we're done.
We're done.
He had the perfect ending. He had the perfect ending. Well, you live here. I can come interview you again sometime. All right, guys.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, Dan. Danielle, good to meet you.
Grazie. Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate it.
And that's our show for this week. Dan Richer and Daniele Uditi, thank you for making that time for me in the midst of your preparation for what looked to be a very ambitious and delicious collaboration. I'm only sorry I wasn't able to come back the next night to enjoy it. Caitlin, thank you for joining me for the intro. To our engineer, Jeet Paul. Jeet, thank you as always for splicing these things together. To everyone at Heritage for your support, I appreciate it. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here next week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.